happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about saffron and other spices that can activate the endocannabinoid system in your body. So not only is it just the cannabinoids from the marijuana plant, cannabis plant, but there's several others that can do something very similar. I'll tell you which ones they are, how they work, why we should use them. And the omega-3 and 6 fatty acids can improve reading for children, so says the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And then mangoes, that delicious fruit from the tropics, could be very important in helping maintain a healthy gut bacteria, especially if you're used to eating high-fat diets. Oklahoma State University shares that. And also from the Ruhr University in Germany, those psychotropic drugs, those are your tranquilizers and antipsychotic medication. According to this, they're not helping you. That means they're hurting you. And more on health and healing. Then today, a special in-depth report from the Center for Investigative Reporting by James B. Steele and Lance Williams entitled, Who Got Rich Off the Student Debt Crisis? I want to share this with you because there are three major problems. There's the student debt, there's the credit card debt, and there's also the car payment debt. I'm not even adding in the mortgage or rent debt. And these are really bubbles, major bubbles. Who profits from them? And this is why it's important we understand that the federal government and its cronies manipulated the system, where one guy who runs the system made over $200 million for himself. And we have to stop for a moment and ask, shouldn't we make all public education tuition free? Take the profit out of it. If you want to pay whatever you want to pay to go to a private institution, that's fine. That's your right. Shouldn't we do the same thing for health care? And I'll show you a way that we could actually not only save money if we had universal health care, but save over $1 trillion a year. And I'll explain that as well. Also today, from the latest research on our being a police state, North Dakota becomes the first U.S. state to legalize the use of armed drones by the police. Armed drones. Well, you know, when one does it, they're all going to do it. The technology's simple. So armed drones could be used by American police. They're going to be used in the state of North Carolina. They could be used anywhere. And they're saying, well, yes, but we wouldn't make them as lethal. Well, they're going to be using rubber bullets. Well, rubber bullets are not rubber. They kill. And also tear gas, lasers, all these other pepper sprays. But now they can get right over your head and nail you. Also today, a commentary that I'm going to ask for talk back on. From Dylan Charles, from Activist Post, the deep state institutions that couldn't care less about who you vote for. Now, I've said this many times, that it's really irrelevant whether it's a Democrat or Republican becomes president, because these are not your power brokers. These are people who accept a certain level of responsibility and a lot of reward. Look at the Clintons as an example, or George Bush. But in return, they're doing someone else's bidding. We just don't pay attention to who those people are. We will today. And I'll show you that no matter who gets elected, nothing is going to change for the deep state or its institutions. If time permits, our audio file will share the biggest scam in the history of America. I'll share that with you. And we'll also have a reality check concerning how does no one go to jail in Wells Fargo when they did so much bad, committed so many criminal acts, pay a fine, and everything's okay. We'll play that as well. Let's begin. A lot of people are, I'm on the road now, and I'll be back shortly finishing up major filming. I intend to premiere in the month of November my newest full-feature documentary, and then in January, another full-feature documentary. And plus, I have three others that are done that I've just premiered on a PBS station in Colorado. So all of you out there listening, you had a chance to see it, hard-hitting. And in one of them, I looked at what impacts the body, the brain, the cells, the heart, the eyes, the muscles, the lungs. How is it that in some people, they're aging a lot slower than others? In other people, they're dying much sooner than what they should. And that's because we don't pay attention to what goes into our body. And we should. There's a consequence. But it's cumulative. By the time you realize maybe I should have made better choices, you may have a heart attack or a cancer, dementia, or something else. I remember a friend of mine coming into the office 3 years ago with her parents. And we had a conversation. And it was about what could they do to get healthier. And they manifested no external problems except just a little bit of memory loss in the mother. And after I heard their lifestyle, I asked, well, are you willing to change? Because they were very clear that every day they liked to have their martinis and they always had social drinking, but never got drunk when they go golfing. And they liked their certain foods. And these none of these were healthy, of course. And I said, well, I can't help you if you're not willing to give up the very things that could cause. Well, look, we're 72 and 76. Nothing's wrong. We're fine. So if you were right, you know, we'd be sick, right? I said, no. I said, my brother Howard smoked for 45 years and said nothing was wrong with smoking three packs a day until he got terminal lung cancer. So when he got cancer, suddenly it caught up with him. Sooner or later, we pay for these bad choices. And so I gave a protocol and a diet and what they should do. And then I was told by the daughter, well, they're not going to do it. They were just looking on the way home. They're not going to do any of this stuff. Okay. Now the mother is in a assisted living center for Alzheimer's. She has complete dementia. She's gone. And the father is also almost there as well. And all that in 3 years. So what we're seeing is a lot of people dying. In fact, a friend of mine yesterday, a longtime friend of mine yesterday, called me. He was very sad, very depressed. He says, Gary, what's happening? He said, all my friends who are around my age, they're all dying or, you know, are dead. And he mentioned a couple of people that I hadn't met in years, decades, that were his friends who died recently. And I said, well, why don't you look at it differently? Why don't you say, look how good I am in feeling and acting because I make better choices. I make good choices. You can't focus upon why someone is sick or has dementia or died because you're not in their life every day. But you just told me a guy died who had diabetes, was overweight, and had high blood pressure. Where's there a mystery there? I don't see where there's a missing equation. It was inevitable that's going to happen. All fat people are going to die sooner rather than later. That's inevitable. Now, trying to understand why they're overweight and what they need to lose the weight and why they won't or they'll yo-yo, that's a different issue. I said, but here you're eating good, you're eating healthy, you're eating organic, you're exercising, and you're in the 100th of 1% in your age group. So shouldn't you look at that, that you're the new model of health? And he said, well, I hadn't thought about that. I said, yeah, you're looking at everyone else who's not living your life. They didn't live a life of being responsible for the choice you made. You have. So why don't you just, yes, we're going to feel sad about those that we love and respect, our friends and family that die. But don't feel that somehow you've been left behind. There's always this kind of guilt in people that why them and not me? Well, did they make the same choices you made? If you're making healthy choices, good for you. Focus upon that. Because if you think that choices don't matter, they do. That said, there were some studies done on spices. And they found that there's certain spices that have a really strong impact upon our cells. Now, we just take these for granted. We almost never eat a spice because of health. We eat it because of its enhancing the taste of something. But a report in the Pharmacognosy Review showed that there is neuroprotective effects of saffron extracts. And why is that important? Because saffron inhibits the buildup of beta amyloid plaque in the brain, and that can help prevent Alzheimer's. And here's what the article said. It said, quote, it also prevents retinal damage, that's your eyes, which is age-related macular degeneration. And then another study, an Italian study, showed that saffron can counteract the effects of continuously bright light exposure, and saffron engages in the CB1 cannabinoid receptor and the CB2 cannabinoid receptor in order to afford retinal protection. So saffron is good. Now, it is the most expensive cultivated herb in the world, and it's very revered for its quality in dishes, mainly originally in Persia and Asia Minor. It comes from a light purple flower with thread-like red-orange stigma that contains about 150 bioactive compounds, including the carotenoids and flavonoids and other potent polyphenols. It's a very rich source of B2, and it has a long history of treating cancer and convulsions and headaches, skin conditions and asthma and ulcers and premenstrual distress. And it's just terrific. In fact, in the Eber's Papyrus of 1550 BC, it refers to saffron as one for the heart. It also helps with kidneys. So start using saffron. How can you use it? Put it into your brown rice. That's a good way. Or your quinoa. Then you have turmeric. And I speak a lot about turmeric. And it's a perennial plant. It's in the ginger family, by the way. And there's a 6,000-year track record as medicinal herb and a culinary spice. It's even used in dyes and in food. And it's just an all-star. It's been known to help you with digestion, with throat infections, with metabolic problems. There's diabetes, common colds, cancer. It does all these wonderful things. If you were to Google turmeric, you would find all these, at least 5,000 peer-reviewed studies on turmeric and its main polyphenolic compound, curcumin, that shows that it heals. There's a great article in the European Journal of Pharmacology on this. Reduces liver fibrosis by modulating the cannabinoid receptor transmission. Then you have peppercorn. Peppercorn, well, when you eat pepper this ground up, you're getting peppercorn. It was once called the black gold. It's the dried fruit of this woody vine. And the peppercorn was considered such a valuable commodity that it served as a substitute for money in business transactions. And during the Middle Ages and in Europe, black pepper was a luxury. Only wealthy people could afford. So what do you get when you're using black pepper? It's all in the science. It reduces nicotine cravings. In fact, one of the ways I help people get off smoking is every time they have a dish, even a drink of juice, I can put some black peppercorn in. And it can ease withdrawal from drugs, including from cocaine. It's an antispasmodic and an anticonvulsant. It can lower blood pressure and relieve digestive distress. Piperine, black pepper's principal bioactive constituent, can inhibit cancer cell proliferation, and especially if osteosarcomas. And black pepper alkaloid potentials are also there for anti-tumor and ability. And again, it works in ways very similar to curcumin. And additionally, black pepper contains vitamin K and iron and manganese, which are good. These are part of the aromatic terpenes, which are also part of the cannabis group. And then you've got nutmeg. And nutmeg also does not directly activate the CB1 cannabinoid receptor in the brain or the CB2 cannabinoid receptor in the immune system, but it really is a powerful stimulator of your endocannabinoid system. There was an article published in Pharmaceutical Biology that shows that nutmeg interacts with the endocannabinoid system by inhibiting certain key enzymes that catabolize or break down the two main endocannabinoid CAG. So it's very powerful for you. Works almost in the brain similar to marijuana. And it's been used to help soothe the mood. It reduces anxiety. It's just terrific. It helps calm the central nervous system. In fact, there was an article in Nature magazine of a meta-analysis that showed that it helped the people who were using it around the world with their immune system. It's also good for diabetes. And also, the omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, according to University of Gothenburg in Sweden, help children read. Your flaxseed oil or walnuts, avocados would be terrific, because it could help the children. In this case, it helped 154 school children from Western Sweden in grade 3 between 9 and 10 years old, and it helped them improve their reading. So it helps the brain. And finally, the mango, wonderful fruit. According to Oklahoma State University, published in the Journal of Nutrition, the mango helps prevent the loss of beneficial gut bacteria caused by a high-fat diet. Quote, we investigated the effects of freeze-dried mango pulp combined with a high-fat diet and on this microbial population and its relation to body composition, and we found that it reduced gut inflammatory markers in diet-induced obesity. In lay language, what it's saying is that when you have mangoes, ideally at the end of a meal, it helps to stabilize the good gut bacteria against the fat in the diet. So that's terrific. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and be right back. Please stay with us.
Teardrops are falling from your Spanish eyes. Please, please don't cry.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Null. We're going to have a talk back segment, and I want to share why I believe that we must take a deeper look at the power structure in our society. I think it's both responsible and reasonable to assume that the people who are out there telling us what we should do, what we should eat, what we should read, what we should wear, how we should study, where we should go to school, these people may believe that they're doing the right thing. But what if there are people behind them who have a different agenda? These are the people known as the deep state. We've always had them. And Danny Sheehan and I exposed these people in a four-hour special earlier this year. According to the Activist Post, the American people are fully enthralled in the puppet show of national elections. You see it every day. And while arguments grow ever more heated and partisan, the fact remains that no matter which way you vote, unless it's Jill Stein, there will remain a deeper state which represents the real and unchanging forces driving the density of this country and the world. Even veteran political people such as the constitutionally minded Ron Paul, some of his ideas I agree with, some I do not. But at least he has been open and public about it and is not afraid to debate the issue. He's come on this program to debate some of these issues. He has stated that your vote doesn't matter as long as the deep state continues to exist, living off funds siphoned from taxpayers and scuttled into covert black ops and secret budgets. And former Republican U.S. Congressional aide Mike Lofgren, who retired in 2011, I think, after 28 years, agreed. Here's what he said about the deep state. Quote, "It is a hybrid of national security and law enforcement agencies, the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Justice Department. I also include the Department of Treasury because of its jurisdiction over financial flows, its enforcement of international sanctions, and its organic symbiosis with Wall Street," end quote. These are the institutions and agencies and ongoing programs that are simply above the law, beyond scrutiny, and they all operate in total secrecy. In my opinion, they truly do not have any interest in what you or I think. They don't care how we vote, because nothing will ever impact them. So let's be very specific. I'm talking about the intelligence agencies. There are 17 of these agencies. Of the 17 agencies, some of the most prominent, the ones you would have heard of, the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and the National Security Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, and the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. Do you really think that any candidate will impact any of these agencies? They will not. And remember, they're funded and with huge budgets, and they have enormous clandestine operations. They're accountable to no one. You have DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and it's the scientific vanguard of the deep state and the world's pioneer of advanced technology. They bring science fiction to life. With an on-the-record annual budget of about $3 billion, their role in our world seems to be to absorb any and all human innovation and redirect it towards the art of killing and controlling people. Let me give you an example. Google search of DARPA reveals an endless array of incredibly cool science projects and public science competitions designed to discover and recruit the greatest upcoming scientific minds that the human race produces. And their influence in our world cannot be understated, both for their positive contributions to society, such as the development of the Internet, no, it was not Al Gore, and for their nefarious reworks of every great scientific idea. Their work will continue unabated no matter who's president. And mind you, they put a happy face on it, they have a good way of spinning it, but they look to militarize everything. Then you have Wall Street and Silicon Valley. Wall Street is the organization of criminal bankers and law firms who manage to reconfigure government and global finance to work in their favor, allowing them to privatize profit and socialize losses, guaranteeing the infinite enrichment of the 0.1%. Now, their power originally garnered with the creation of the central banking and the banking corporations like the Federal Reserve. When was the last time anyone in public office took on the legitimacy of the Federal Reserve? I've said many times the Federal Reserve is a criminal organization, and it should be completely deconstructed in its 12-member banks have investigated to show how they've enriched themselves, gorged themselves over the many decades, over nearly 100 years, and yet they control the money supply, not the treasury. They control the interest rates. Now, who benefits when you have a zero interest rate? The banks, the people who want to create debt because they're not going to have any interest service on that debt. So the Federal Reserve is not going to be changed. No matter who's in office, Wall Street won't change, Silicon Valley won't change. And that's how it is. And you combine the powers of Wall Street and Silicon Valley, they effectively own the U.S. government. And therefore, no candidate is going to go into office today that has them as in their sights for reform or change. Then you have the military-industrial complex, defense contractors. This is an Orwellian permanent war machine. It's not important for them to have a war as much as them to posit that we will be in war, always making people feel insecure. The list of defense contractors that comprise the military-industrial complex and manufacture and produce the equipment and war materials that makes endless wars a permanent feature of the modern world is, you can read it. It's right in Business Insider. At the top of the list of the nine companies, Lockheed Martin, followed by Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, all receiving tens of billions of dollars annually from the federal government. That's you and I. Their power is derived from the good old boy revolving door network of government insiders and private sector free agents who compete for taxpayer money and contracts. Both Trump and Clinton are supportive of this network. So take your pick. They both want to give more money to these same people. Then you have the secret black budget and the space programs. These are the programs that are spoken of mostly in rumors. The best guess is they are funded by money stolen from the American people and operate in locations in their what is called their fabled dumps, deep underground bases, under the protection of the military. We know they exist because the occasional media leak about their technological achievements and their secretly funded programs, yet no one ever questions them. And former Wall Street Investment Bank director and former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development during the first Bush administration, Catherine Austin Fitz, estimates that some $40 trillion in taxpayer money has disappeared in decades from the budgets of the Pentagon and other agencies and has been covertly directed towards the operations of these deep state institutions. So when you hear that, oh, we have a domestic debt of $18-plus trillion, no, that's not true. The Pentagon alone is missing $6.5 trillion. The deep state knows where the funding is. The deep state creates all of this. And I remember once my last lecture in Washington, D.C., before I signed off on PFW after 31 years, and I did it as a fundraiser for the station, and I didn't know where it was, and I'm standing across the street in this little theater outside. I saw three people going. I'm thinking, wow, that's not much of a turnout, and I'd always packed houses down in Washington, so someone came by and says, Gary, aren't you starting? I said, yeah, I'm waiting for the people to come in. He said, well, it's not here. It's across the street. There's a huge civic center across the street. I was at the wrong place. So I walked across the street, walked inside, and just it was bigger than an airplane hangar. It was so big, it had different screens going clear down walls. So one when the movie I was showing three movies that day plus doing 3 hours. It was a whole day from noon till six hours I was with them. So people could watch this, and it was standing room only. And afterwards, a man came up to me, and he said, can I speak with you in confidence for a moment? I said, yeah. He said, you know, when you're talking about the deep state and who really controls Washington, he said, I just want to let you know that I'm a part of that. I won't tell you my name or where I work, but you are absolutely right on, but there's something you didn't know. You did, or if you know, you didn't mention it. Here's how it really works today. He said, let's say that this morning I go to play racquetball. my buddy and I that are playing racquetball really don't care about the racquetball. We care about the deals that we're making. My buddy is a senator's chief of staff. And let's say I work for a lobbying firm, a K Street lobbying firm. Now, I'm promising this guy that if he gets the senator to pass a piece of legislation that will impact the product of my client, that he can retire from there. I'll give him a black American Express card, unlimited. I'll give him, he can lease any car he wants, a Jaguar, BMW, whatever. We'll get him, when he can travel on our corporate jets, when he wants to go places, ball game tickets, and suddenly he's invited into every A party in this area. And there's a whole lot of people like him. And so he says, okay, I want nothing in writing. I don't want any paper trail. I don't want any meetings in any office. So we have plausible deniability. So over a period of a year, he lobbies the senator. The senator then sits as a chairman of a committee, passes a piece of legislation, and now this lobbyist's firm that he represents makes billions of dollars. So giving this guy $500,000 to start, plus all these other perks which are worth $500,000, he's making 10 times more than what he made working as in Congress. And now, Gary, imagine that there are, are you ready for this? Imagine there are 30,000 lobbyists, minimum, 100,000 consultants, and at least 30 to 40,000 former legislative aides or people, legislators, all working within a pool. And that pool is the American monies, and that's what they take from. And you'll never be able to stop it, because once they get a contract in any bureaucracy, any agency, all they do is expand it. And then they subcontract out the work, and that's who makes the money. The subcontractors make the money. And there are over 200,000 subcontractors in the Washington, D.C. area. And that's what the American media won't touch. That's what no one knows. That's your deep state. And we talked for about a half hour, and then he left, because I had to rush back to get a plane back to New York. And that was just one example of the deep state. So you see, at the end of the day, unless you do get a Jill Stein, a real change person, if you vote for either of the two candidates, you're getting the deep state, and they're the front for it. But they're not who they are. What do you believe we should do about it? What are your thoughts? What are your solutions? Now, I'll give you two solutions right now. One is, if we were to have universal health care, we would save over $1.5 trillion a year. How? Because over $1 trillion goes to the insurance agencies for their spectacular salaries, into the tens of millions of dollars to those who run them, to their private jets. All that is written off as part of their overhead, and even their lobbying money to keep them in power. But they do nothing, and you bypass them. You don't need that bureaucracy anymore, because you're not telling someone, well, you can only go to this doctor and only get this part of the therapy, but you can't get that. No, you're totally covered. Now, also, you eliminate anywhere between $200 to $300 billion in fraud. You also then can control the prices of drug. That saves you about $300 billion, because you get the cheaper variety of the generic drug that you actually need. You also save another $200 billion from defensive medicine. A doctor overtests you, overtreats you, because they're afraid of being sued. So if you have no fault medical where you cannot sue the doctor or the hospital, you can bring a suit about your injury, and you will be compensated from a fund, lost wages or whatever has happened to you. Yes. So it becomes an enormous savings. We're spending $3.5 trillion. The largest amount of money spent in world history on anything is being spent every single year on healthcare. And look at how bad it is. So that's one thing we can do. And we can do that under universal Medicare. Separately, if those people still wanted their private insurance, let them have it. But for everyone else, you've got universal. Now, even universal, how do you pay for it? You take the profit out of healthcare. You take it out of the hospitals. You take it out of the drugs. You take it out the doctors, and in return to help the doctors, you pay for their education, and you give them a living wage based upon what the average doctor has made in their specialty over a five-year period, starting when they get out of medical school. So in internship and residency, you no longer do these as boot camps, which are stupid and worthless, and you treat these people in terrible situations. You overstress them. They have no debt. They're not being worked. They're making a living wage. So you cap what they can make, a reasonable living wage. If you really want to be a doctor because you want to help people, now you can. You're not in debt. You're not being overworked, but you're free to do the medicine that you want. Eliminate all the state medical boards. They're completely corrupt, inept political machines. And get the AMA out of medicine and the Union of Doctors out of medicine, because that's all it is. And then introduce curriculums that also contain understanding stress, environmental issues, nutrition, things that are completely avoided now. And then watch how many diseases we prevent. Now, have one flat income tax. You can eliminate personal income tax. We shouldn't be taxing people's income. But you have a sales tax at the state level, graduated, very low for everyday items, higher, escalating to highest for very expensive items. If you want something very expensive and you can afford it, pay more sales tax. That helps the state. But then at the federal level, every single corporation must pay a flat tax, let's say 20%. That brings in an extra $1.5 trillion. Right now, you're not getting that $1.5. They're avoiding paying those taxes. So this way, if you put a 1% tax on all trades, including algorithm trades on Wall Street, you've just paid for your entire medical care. Now you've got a budget surplus instead of budget deficit. Realistic, doable, but not with our current systems, because so many people profit off our ignorance. So what would you do about the deep state? What would you do about the media never talking about the deep state? No candidate going against the deep state. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And let me tell you about two ways the deep state works. One is they control the banks, and therefore they control the Justice Department. Our Justice Department is a farce. And let me just play a little clip about nobody goes to jail from Wells Fargo for out-and-out fraud. This is one way they work every single day, and they get away with it because we allow it.
Wells Fargo has agreed to pay a $190 million settlement to the federal government after it admits that thousands of employees open fraudulent and unauthorized accounts for customers. So the big question, how does no one go to jail for this? This is a reality check you won't see anywhere else. So Wells Fargo has agreed to pay this massive $190 million fine and has fired 5,300 employees. So what was taking place? In two words, massive fraud. 1.5 million checking accounts and 500,000 credit cards of fake accounts were set up using real customers' names in order for more than 5,000 employees to hit lofty sales goals. Now, in addition to the fact that they were overcharged, overdraft and maintenance fees, some customers also dealt with significant hits to their credit scores as a result of not staying current on accounts that they didn't even know they had. Since 2011, Wells Fargo says $2.6 million has been refunded to customers who received an average of $25. Out of that $100 million fine, only $5 million will go to victims. $185 million will go to the federal government. Wells Fargo has also said that they are firing managers and that it was making investments in enhanced team member training and monitoring and control. So how is it that while employees lose their jobs, nobody goes to jail? I want you to look at this definition here. The fraudulent acquisition and use of a person's private identifying information, usually for financial gain. So the question is that what took place? Using a person or customer's identifying information in order to set up an account that they did not request or want in order to hit sales goals or financial gain. Yeah, that's exactly what was happening here. And this, by the way, is the exact definition of identity theft. Under federal law, let alone additional state laws, identity theft, it carries a penalty of up to 15 years in prison, as well as substantial fines. In Wells Fargo's case, No one's going to jail, and the fine, well, take a look at this, it's really not substantial. It's $190 million. It's just over 3% of the $5.6 billion in revenue that Wells Fargo pulled in for just the second quarter of this year. So what you need to know is that when Wells Fargo agreed to pay this pittance of a fine, the government also agreed to something else. It gave the bank immunity for any uncovered crimes that may have taken place during the same time period. So in short, no one goes to jail. The bank pays a comparatively tiny fine. The government gets a big pile of cash. And the victims, they get about $25 per person. So what about this deal would actually stop Wells Fargo or any other bank from doing the exact same thing over and over and over again in the future? That's Reality Check. Let's talk about that tonight.
Okay, that's just one example. When was the last time you heard of any employee of any federal agency that had committed a crime that was held accountable, like the CAA and its rendition and torture? You don't. That's the power of them. Now I want to spend the rest of our time, and if calls come in on this, I'll be happy to take your calls. This is a report from James B. Steele and Lance Williams of the Center for Investigative Reporting. And it's about the student debt, because we could very easily, the solution's simple, we could simply forgive the student debt, because it's an amount that is only 1/20 of what we forgave for Wall Street and big corporations. So if we could forgive their debt, why can't we forgive student debt? A generation ago, Congress privatized a student loan program intended to give more Americans access to higher education. So here's what we have to understand. In its place, lawmakers, and they didn't do this unintentionally, they created another profit center for Wall Street and the system of college finance that has fed the nation's cycle of inequality. I'll explain step by step. Congress has enacted one law after another to make student debt the worst kind of debt for Americans and the best kind of debt for banks and debt collectors. And today, just about everyone involved in the student loan industry makes money off students. The banks, private investors, even the federal government. Jesse Surin is a good example. Jesse is a energetic 28-year-old who wanted a career in law enforcement. And Albert Lord is a 70-year-old former accountant who became a multimillionaire executive. Now, the two have never met, but their stories tell the history of American student debt crisis. Surin attended a free boarding school for underprivileged youth in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and enrolled in LaSalle University in Philadelphia under a scholarship. But the scholarship didn't cover the cost of the private college, so she borrowed about $71,000 for it from Sallie Mae. More on Sallie Mae in a few moments. That's the financial giant of the student loan industry. Now, Surin did well in school, but a job with U.S. Marshals Service fell through, and by graduation in 2010, she had a soaring loan balance and no career prospects. In the years since then, Surin has scrambled to keep current on her loans, sometimes working 16 hours a day at two low-paying jobs, and her finances are incredibly tight, and she has made no headway on her loans. Today, her balance is over $90,000. There's your interest. Quote, "My loans are a black cloud hanging over me. I'm a student debt slave." For Lord, student loans have been the road to riches. He was the CEO who built Sallie Mae into a financial colossus through fees, interest, and commissions on billions of dollars of federally guaranteed student loans for delivering handsome profits to investors. Lord received stock and money worth hundreds of millions of dollars. His success made him one of the highest paid executives in Washington, gave him entree to an elite circle of power brokers, and won him a seat on the board of the Washington Redskins Charitable Foundation. So with his wealth, he started a private equity company, built a golf course, his own, and so he had a 30-year career at the forefront of the student loan industry. He retired in 2013, and shuttles between his houses. Almost every American knows someone like Surin, an adult burdened by a student loan. Fewer know that growing alongside the legions of indebted students is a formidable private industry that has been enriched by student debt. Decades ago, the federal government relinquished direct control of the student loan program, opening its bank to corporations concerned with profit, not diplomas. Private equity companies and Wall Street banks seized on the flow of federal loan dollars by peddling loans that students sometimes could not afford and then collecting fees from the government to hound those students when they defaulted. And once in place, the privatized student loan industry has succeeded largely in preserving the status quo in Washington. Student loans are virtually the only consumer debt that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. At the same time, societal changes conspired to drive up the basic need for these loans. What do I mean? I mean that middle-class income stagnated, college costs soared, and states retreated from their historical investment in public universities. If states had continued to support public higher education at the rate they had in 1980, they would have invested at least $500 billion in their university systems. That's according to the analysis by Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Now, that's an amount roughly equal to the outstanding student debt now held by those who enrolled in public college and university. The calculus for students and their families changed dramatically with little notice. Today, there is a student debt class like no other. More than 40 million Americans bearing $1.3 trillion in debt that's altering lives and relationships and even retirement. And one of the winners in the profit spree behind this debt, the federal government. By the Department of Education's own calculations, the government earns, in some years, an astounding 20% on every student loan. Quote, the United States government turns young people who are trying to get an education into profit centers to bring in more revenue for the federal government. This is obscene. The federal government should be helping students get an education, not making a profit off their backs. And quote, that was Elizabeth Warren. The student debt crisis is a microcosm of America, a tale of the haves and have-nots. Students who attend the richest schools often have less debt than students who graduate from state colleges. Students from lower moderate income families who attend for-profit schools usually take on the heaviest debt load of all. After all, it makes a big difference if you got parents who are well-to-do because they can always step in and be the safety net, pay off those loans. For middle-class families, no. The imbalance between those with debt and those without will exacerbate income inequality for decades. Now, the Obama administration has taken steps towards reform, but it's just a step. They just eliminated some of the middlemen, but that doesn't change anything. The basic system remains in place. Contractors with historically little oversight from the federal government have an incentive to make a profit by collecting as much as they can from student debtors. Today, student debt is a $150 billion a year industry. And unlike many of its customers, the industry's future is very bright. If you just stroll through a rally at New York University, students protesting rising loan debt, a writer for the Debt Industry publication found himself face-to-face with students carrying placards and wearing T-shirts proclaiming their frustration. But all we could see were dollar signs. Why? Because for every student, they make money. In fact, that rally was in 2011. In the 5 years since, total debt has risen by nearly $500 billion more dollars. So it's not hard to see why people such as Jesse Surin are feeling squeezed and misled, and why loans that appeared smart and easily turned out to be anything but. Stories such as Surin's are everywhere, whether the borrowers attended a prestigious university or for-profit schools, whether they wanted to be computer programmers or fashion designers, whether they were studying biology or graphic design. Members of the new debtor class talk about how easy it is to borrow to go to college and how no one, not even their parents, warned them about the risks they were assuming. They talk about colleges that make it seem safe to borrow by assuring them that everyone had loans. They talk about how they want to pay off their loans but can't earn enough to do that. They say they didn't realize how dramatically their loan balance could soar if they missed payments. They speak of the embarrassment of being hounded by debt collectors, and they talk about stress, relieving stress of knowing probably never will be free of debt. This is not the problem that President Lyndon Johnson envisioned when he signed one of the signature bills of his Great Society program, the Higher Education Act, 1965. A linchpin of Johnson's effort to wipe out racial injustice and poverty, the act was meant to ensure that any student who wanted to go to college would be able to go through federal scholarships and loans. Before the law, most Americans who wanted to go to college had to finance it themselves. That meant paying out of your own pocket or securing a scholarship or taking out an expensive private loan. And after the bill, students could go to a bank for a less costly student loan guaranteed by the federal government. Under President Richard Nixon, Congress expanded the program, and in 1972, by creating a quasi-government agency, the Student Loan Marketing Association, or Sallie Mae, to increase the amount of money available for student loans. Sallie Mae was viewed as an enlightened expansion of Johnson's program because it established a market for federally backed student loans. Banks loaned to students, and Sallie Mae bought the loans from the banks, increasing the pool of money available for loans. And when the Children of the Great Society had children of their own, the government's role in student loan dramatically changed. So in comes Bill Clinton. Gee, why should we be surprised? And he would be the catalyst for change, but not the way he wanted. After he was elected in 1992, Clinton pushed through Congress a major revision of the student loan program that made the federal government the direct lender of the loans, not just the insurer. Clinton's program eliminated the middleman between the government-backed loans and students. The direct loan program alarmed Sallie Mae and the banks. Now they had to compete with a government-run program that could make loans at a lower interest rate without having to turn a profit. And when Republicans won Congress in 1994, they moved to kill the direct loan program and privatize Sallie Mae. A year of political infighting ensued until Clinton and congressional Republicans reached a compromise, one that essentially saved the program. In return, Clinton agreed to privatize Sallie Mae. So in these upcoming debates, why don't we see a moderator say, what part did you play, since you were the co-president under your husband Bill Clinton, in the privatization of Sallie Mae? Because upon the passage of the bill in 1996, then it became the paving the way for more people to make money. Clinton's direct loan program had been saved, but it would be marginalized by Sallie Mae. And before privatization, Sallie Mae had little flexibility. But afterwards, they could run wild with it. It was all this back office operations. They were working with collection agency. After all, if the government's going to insure a loan, then think of all the people who are going to take out the loan. Suddenly, a full array of services that had been parceled out among government agencies or contractors, from making loans to collecting premiums and penalty fees, could be consolidated under Sallie Mae's umbrella. It had a dramatic impact. And while the Department of Education technically still oversaw student loans, the message of Congress couldn't be clear. Bureaucrats, step aside and let the private market run the loan program. Sallie Mae dominates the market, and the man who would be most of this newly privatized industry was Howard Lord, who became CEO of Sallie Mae in 1997. And Lord is like a partition born into the manor. He was the son of a newspaper type operator who approached nature masked up in a way that would stone knees. And under Lord, Sallie Mae by leaps and bounds because it had no government control. It emerged as the dominant company in the field. So Lord's chief competition when he took over was the Education Department's direct loan program created by Clinton. And since its adoption in 1993, the program had gained popularity steadily on college campuses and captured a third of the student loan market by the time Sallie Mae was privatized. Sallie Mae undermined the federal government by sheer marketing muscle, and the company paid colleges to drop out of the federal program and make Sallie Mae the campus student loan provider. It paid college financial loan officers to serve as consultants on Sallie Mae's advisory board. It paid a New Jersey agency $15 million to steer business to Sallie Mae. It placed Sallie Mae employees in university call centers to field questions from students who thought they were getting advice from a college loan officer. No, you were getting it from a Sallie Mae employee. It sponsored trips and cruises for collegiate financial aid officers. Other student loan officers engaged in similar practices. Needless to say, the Department of Education didn't have a budget to entertain college-age officials with free cruises. And faced with industry lobbying and congressional opposition, the Department of Education struggled to maintain the direct loan program. And so after George Bush took office in 2001, the program was cut back further. And that's how Sallie Mae began marketing private student loans. And these loans have higher interest rates and higher fees and give borrowers fewer options. So if you can't pay, you run into financial trouble. Nevertheless, college loan officers say many students succumb to the sales pitch of private lenders because they either don't realize that private loans are more expensive or have maxed out their federal loans. And private loans make up a small portion of the total student loan debt, but it's still a huge number, over $100 billion a year. Lord had created an integrated student loan operation encompassing every phase of the growing industry, and the company became a financial juggernaut. So that's how it works. So Lord retired with $200 million. Not bad. And today we have a massive mess. We could forgive all this loan business and then create state institutions, public schools without tuition. How do you pay it? Simple. 1% fee for every transaction on Wall Street would pay every year the entire free education for any American who wanted to take it. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our program. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't.